This podcast episode contains adult themes and violence and is not intended for all audiences. Listener discretion is advised. Hi, everyone. I want to thank all of you who have taken the time to listen and to give me feedback so far. Being a total podcast newbie, I'm really enjoying learning how to write, produce, record, and edit as I go. Each episode, I learn something new or creative, so I hope you'll stick with me for the ride. This is the fifth episode since the launch of The Blood Evidence just 2 weeks ago. I wasn't kidding when I said I really love true crime and telling stories. We're going to take a break from murder for this one. There is some detail of serious crimes of abduction and rape, so I will give the trigger warning ahead of time for those who don't want to hear some bad language and very sexual adult content. But this one captures a little more of the science behind the scenes. And though the science can be incredibly useful in the wrong hands of someone who has no ethics or moral fiber, it can destroy lives. Forensic DNA, though it can play a critical role in solving criminal cases, especially the unsolved cold cases as we heard in the Dr. Helena Greenwood case, can lead to a miscarriage of justice. DNA evidence has been misused and misunderstood, and the interpretation of results can be very subjective depending on if it's the prosecution or the defense team reading them. Deoxyribonucleic acid, or DNA, is the blueprint for how we grow, function, and develop. Humans are thought to be 99.9% genetically identical, with only a mere 0.1% of the genome distinguishing each person with unique characteristics. The fact that humans and chimpanzees have only a 1% difference in DNA makeup further highlights how meaningful a small difference can be. The tiny part unique to each person can be used to create what is called a DNA profile. The profile is graphically represented by highlighting different peaks, which reports the patterns as different points where our DNA is most likely to be unique to us. The process of identifying an individual's characteristics within DNA, which are as unique as fingerprints, has had some remarkable success. We saw this in the 80s Green River Killer case, where the killer strangled 50 women and dumped their bodies along the Green River in Washington state. It took 2 decades and the advance in DNA technology to catch him. While utilizing relatively new technology in 2001, the polymerase chain reaction and short tandem repeat testing, or STR testing, making it possible to analyze minute portions of DNA, they were able to finally identify the killer by taking a semen sample from a suspect, Gary Ridgway, who strangled a prostitute in 1980, so this fits his MO, and being able to match it to other Green River victims. However, no technology is perfect, and neither is DNA profiling and definitively identifying an individual. Ideally, a sample's DNA would be very clean and complete with at least 16 markers. Markers are points where the DNA can be sketched out. But as you can imagine with the crime scene, it's not clean at all. The DNA can be damaged, and not just because there could be very little of it, but also contamination of the crime scene by investigators and degradation caused by exposure to natural elements like moisture and extreme heat. Realistically then, DNA profiles should only be considered as likely to come from any one individual, and because of this, a more statistical approach called the likelihood ratio was established. This is the likelihood of DNA coming from the killer versus the DNA coming from someone else. If the likelihood ratio is more than one, the prosecution has more support of the sample taken from the scene or victim is the suspect's. But if the ratio is less than one, the defense can argue that the DNA came from someone else. Still, the ratio at most provides scientific support for a theory, but it's not a clear-cut yes or no, as dramatized television shows portray. Again, in the 80s, this was a hell of a time for crime, it seems. 2 very horrific abductions and rapes occurred to 2 women at different times and locations. I want to give the trigger warning here. The details I'm going to go through are extremely graphic with bad language, and it could be upsetting to listen to. If you want to skip over about 8 to 10 minutes or so following this intro, feel free. It's understandable why any state would want to lock up whoever is responsible for committing these acts to get them off the street to prevent more from happening. There is also a lot at play behind the scenes. There is politics, media coverage, and pressure from the community. But as we know, it takes great care and time to truly convict someone. In the case of the rapes I'm going to discuss, a man named Glenn Woodall ended up taking the rap and was sentenced to 355 years in prison. The problem is, he didn't do it. The most unlucky thing happened to him, in which at the time, a police lab chemist and director of physical forensic evidence in West Virginia named Fred Zane, who was highly loved by the prosecution, and you will see why, was assigned to run his lab tests. It would be exposed later that Fred Zane falsified lab results and provided erroneous information when he testified for the state to have locked up over 134 innocent men. Glenn Woodall would be the first man exonerated by the Innocence Project after wrongfully serving 5 years in prison. I'm now going to read verbatim the summary of the State versus Woodall from the Supreme Court of Appeals of West Virginia from July 6, 1989. On January 22, 1987, at about 1:15 p.m., a woman was abducted at knife point from the parking lot of the Huntington Mall in Barboursville, West Virginia, by a man wearing a ski mask. The masked assailant forced the victim to shut her eyes throughout the attack. Repeatedly threatening to kill her, the assailant drove the victim in her own car around Cabell County. While driving the car, the assailant had the victim raise her arms. He tore and cut her clothing and fondled her breasts. He ordered her to spread her legs. When she refused, he forced them apart, saying, "Spread your legs, bitch, and do what I tell you to, and you won't get hurt. I'm only going to give you a few minutes, and then I'll let you go." He ordered her up and jerked her skirt aside. He hacked the victim's underwear with a knife and fingered her genitals. Holding the knife to her genitals, the assailant threatened to cut her up. "You don't think I'll do it, do you, bitch?" The victim pled for mercy. Driving on a few minutes, the attacker then forced the victim to fellate him, again holding a knife to her throat. Angered at her attitude, he jerked her up into her seat. The victim sought solace in prayer. Her attacker accosted her. "What are you doing, bitch? You talk to me. What are you up to?" He again forced fellatio. While that continued, he cut the victim's skirt and fingered her rectum, then her vagina. Claiming she didn't enjoy his attacks, he made her sit again with her head in her lap. Stopping the car, the attacker forced the victim to her knees. He threatened her again. "You better shut up, bitch, because I'll kill you. I've killed someone before, and I'll do it to you." He sodomized her and then raped her. He then forced her into the back seat of the car, had her lie on her stomach, and sodomized her. He then raped her again. Biting the victim on the back, the attacker dismounted and had the victim get in the front seat and compose herself. He again threatened, "I'm going to have to kill you because I know you saw me." The assailant searched the victim's purse, taking all her money, which is $5, and her watch. He again forced fellatio. The victim briefly opened her eyes, noting that the attacker wore brown pants and that he was uncircumcised. Cursing her, the assailant then let her out of the car. He claimed a friend was following who would hurt her if she opened her eyes. He knew who she was, he said, and his friend would kill her if she called the police. When she finally opened her eyes, the victim was alone on a roadside. She sought help from a woman nearby. It was then 2 p.m. 45 minutes had passed since the abduction began. Another woman was held in the same terror a few weeks later on February 16, 1987. At 3 p.m., she entered her car in the Huntington Mall parking lot and then got out again to scrape ice from the windscreen. As she re-entered the car, a man jumped her, struck her, and forced her into the passenger seat. He told her to shut up and close her eyes. If you know who I am, or if you see me, I'll kill you, he threatened. He rummaged through her pocketbook, accosted her by name, and then asked her personal questions. He claimed to be acting for a friend, revenging some slight by the victim. The attacker bound the victim's eyes and hands with tape. He seized the gold wristwatch she wore. The victim was able to see slightly with her right eye and observed that the assailant drove her car out of the parking lot and onto Interstate 64 East. On the way, he pulled open the victim's clothing and fingered her vagina. He forced the victim to fellate him. Then he struck her and pushed her back to the passenger side of the car. As the car slowed to a stop at the Milton exit, the victim tried to unlock the door to escape. The attacker struck her to the floor and yelled that he would kill her if she tried to escape. The assailant drove into a secluded spot and parked to, quote, wait for his, quote, buddy in a van, he said. He took off the victim's clothes, climbed atop her, and raped her. After a bit, he forced her to climb on top of him, maneuvering with the car, and raped her again. He turned the victim on her stomach and again raped her. He then flipped her over onto her back and again raped her. The assailant had the victim put on her clothes and began driving the car. He told her, "You'll not live to see another day. You won't see anything else." He stopped the car, claiming his, quote, buddy's van was there. He taped the victim's hands to the gear shift, then took some time wiping the car interior and effects with paper towels he found there. He left her. She counted to 60 several times, then looked up to see that she had been returned to the Huntington Mall. About an hour had passed since she had first been abducted. She drove herself to the hospital. Glendale Woodall stands convicted of 19 criminal counts arising from these two attacks on women in the Huntington area. Counts 1 through 7 charged first-degree sexual assault as to the first victim, count 9 charged kidnapping of the first victim, and count 10 charged aggravated robbery of the first victim. Counts 11 through 15 charged first-degree sexual assault of the second victim. Counts 16 and 17 charged first-degree sexual abuse of the second victim. Count 18 charged kidnapping of the second victim. And count 19 charged aggravated robbery of the second victim. Okay, back to my narration. Glenn Woodall was an itinerant gravedigger and handyman when he was convicted of the two crimes. The prosecution's evidence included a partial identification by one of the victims, a piece of clothing seized from Woodall's house, and an identification of a smell common to the perpetrator in Woodall's workplace. Conventional serology and hair comparisons could not exclude him. When the DNA tests were conducted, the results were inconclusive. He was sentenced to 2 life sentences, totaling the 355 years. He continually appealed the conviction, begging for additional DNA testing. PCR testing was performed on sperm found in the rape kits of the victims. The DQ alpha types from both samples matched each other but excluded Woodall. The results were then duplicated by another laboratory and produced the same results. Based on these results, Woodall was granted a hearing and his conviction vacated. He had to wear an electronic monitoring bracelet until a testing method called RFLP was performed. This completely eliminated him as a suspect. He had served 5 years in prison for a crime he didn't commit. RFLP stands for Restriction Fragment Length Polymorphism. In molecular biology, RFLP is a technique that exploits variations in homologous DNA sequences in order to distinguish individuals. Restriction enzymes fragment the DNA strands, and then they are run on gel electrophoresis for separation and identification. This testing method has been largely replaced by next-generation DNA sequencing, a technique that I am very familiar with in my own career, but it was one of the first used in forensic DNA profiling. This is a technology that would free Woodall. So, who is Fred Zane, And how was he ultimately responsible for ruining so many people's lives, including Glenn Woodall? Let's start with his background. Zane was born on April 14th in 1951. As an adult, he was hired as a chemist in a West Virginia state lab with the rank of trooper in the West Virginia State Police, which ran the lab. He eventually rose to director of the serology department in the State Department of Public Safety. Let's digress for just a second, and here's a little science lesson. I've mentioned serology a couple of times, and you're going to hear it a lot in this episode. If you don't know, serology is the scientific study of serum and other bodily fluids. In practice, the term usually refers to the diagnostic identification of antibodies in the serum. Such antibodies are typically formed in response to an infection against a given microorganism, against other foreign proteins, in response, for example, to a mismatched blood transfusion, or to one's own proteins, in the instances of autoimmune disease. Forensic serology is the detection, identification, and study of various bodily fluids, such as blood, semen, saliva, urine, vomit, fecal matter, and perspiration. Serology testing begins with presumptive tests, which gives the analyst an indication that a specific bodily fluid may be present, but cannot completely confirm its presence. Following the presumptive tests are the confirmatory tests that confirms what the unknown substance actually is. Testing for different body fluids with traditional serological techniques, such as those listed above, is possible, but not without some drawbacks. Firstly, not all body fluids have a reliable confirmatory test, and those that do typically require a larger amount of the suspected stain in order to perform the confirmatory test. This can be limiting if the forensic sample being tested is small to begin with. Also, serology is often done before any downstream analyses like DNA. So if a sample is limited in size to begin with, performing serological analyses and obtaining a DNA profile successfully may not be possible. This complicated and very important process was what Zane oversaw. What the police didn't know was that Zane had lied about his credentials. He claimed that he graduated from West Virginia State College, now West Virginia State University. He said he majored in biology and minored in chemistry. He did major in biology, but barely passed with a grade average of a C. The job which he was hired for, chemistry, he never minored in. He had taken a few chemistry courses, but he either flunked out or barely passed them. He also failed an FBI forensic science course, but nevertheless, no one checked his background upon hiring. Early on, Zane gained a great reputation with the state. He was able to solve very complex cases and was looked on as a, quote, god for West Virginia prosecutors. His reputation was so shining that prosecution attorneys throughout the country always wanted him as their expert witness. There were problems with Zane, but his supervisors chose to ignore them. In 1985, FBI director at the time, James Greer, told the state police that he had failed basic courses in serology and bloodstain analysis. No corrective action took place. And on top of that, two workers saw Zane record results from totally blank plates. However, the complaints were not taken seriously because he claimed that he and his co-workers just didn't get along. He was obviously very, quote, pro-prosecution, but this obvious bias did not put up any red flags for some reason. It angers me so much because if anyone should be the most objective, it's scientists. But as we now know, he was never a real scientist. Zane was the expert witness on the semen analysis for the 1987 case against Woodall for the two rape cases at the Huntington Mall in which he was convicted. Woodall's defense team ended up conducting their own blood DNA tests, which ultimately exonerated him. But a bigger issue was that Zane's credibility had been debunked. It became public knowledge that he had used flawed blood typing methods in order to link Woodall to the semen from the victim rape kits. More seriously, it was appeared that Zane had determined a piece of hair was unidentifiable pubic hair, but later changed his testimony that it was a beard hair from Woodall. Despite Woodall's exoneration, Zane's testimony was not directly impeached because the serological tests that Zane had used were not as discriminating as the newly developed DNA tests. Nevertheless, Woodall sued the state for false imprisonment. When the state's insurer settled for $1 million after investigating Zane's work, reporters jumped on the story. This resulted in an internal audit, a grand jury investigation, and a legislative commission probe of Zane's conduct. At the request of the state police, Kanawha County Prosecutor William Forbes began a criminal investigation. Forbes was so disturbed by what he found that he asked the Supreme Court of Appeals of West Virginia to appoint a special judge and a panel of lawyers and scientists to investigate the serology department. On November 4, 1993, Senior Circuit Court Judge James Holliday issued a report finding that Zane had engaged in a staggering litany of misconduct and outright fraud. According to the report, Zane had misstated evidence, falsified lab results, and reported scientifically implausible results that may have resulted in as many as 134 people being wrongfully convicted. Holliday found that Zane's misconduct was so egregious that any testimony offered by Zane should be presumed as prima facie, which means invalid, unreliable, and inadmissible. It also found serious deficiencies in the serology division's quality control procedures. The Supreme Court unanimously accepted Holliday's report on November 12th, calling Zane's actions egregious violations of the right of a defendant to a fair trial and a corruption of our legal system. An investigation in Texas found that while working with the Bexar County Medical Examiner's Office, Zane had engaged in misconduct and fraud that may have resulted in as many as 180 wrongful convictions. As in West Virginia, the Texas investigation found numerous instances of Zane filing reports on tests that had never even been done, reporting negative results as positive and describing inconclusive results as conclusive. Bexar County fired him after his misconduct in West Virginia came to light. Reviews over the cases he presided led to dropped charges and overturned convictions in multiple cases in West Virginia and Texas. West Virginia alone ended up paying out a combined total of $6.5 million to settle lawsuits by people who had been wrongfully convicted due to Zane. Zane was charged with fraud, but his trial was put on indefinite hold after he was diagnosed with liver cancer. In 2001, he was charged on 4 counts of obtaining money under false pretenses, but the jury deadlocked. A new fraud trial was later scheduled for July 2003. But in December of 2002, Zane succumbed to his liver cancer and died in his Ormond Beach, Florida home. Another innocent man that I have the story for besides Glenn Woodall that Zane affected, who ended up serving 10 years in prison based on the information from the Innocence Project, caused by the false lab testing and testimony by Fred Zane, is James Richardson. On May 18, 1989, James Richardson was standing outside of his father's house in Cross Lanes, West Virginia, when he noticed that a neighboring house was burning. He kicked in the door, rescued a 3-year-old girl, and then called the police. The girl's mother, Kelly Gilfillan, was found inside bound, raped, and beaten to death. Richardson became a suspect because he was at the scene, and he was arrested shortly thereafter. At Richardson's trial, Zane testified falsely that serological testing on semen from the crime scene linked Richardson to the crime and excluded 3 other suspects. The jury convicted Richardson on July 27, 1989, and he was sentenced to life imprisonment without parole, based in large part on Zane's testimony. Because of the Zane scandal, his conviction was re-examined. In this case, it turned out that Zane had not taken into account the victim's blood group markers. Because the victim's blood group markers could have masked those of the perpetrator, no potential perpetrator could be excluded through serology. Reinvestigation uncovered additional problems as well. Police had withheld a flashlight that was found at the scene of the crime covered with blood.
DNA testing indicated that blood on the flashlight did not come either from Richardson or from the victim. In addition, previously undisclosed statements to police by the victim's 3-year-old daughter suggested that she had seen some of the crime and that Richardson was not the attacker. Richardson was released to home confinement in 1996 after his conviction was set aside. In 1998, he was released from home confinement, and in July 1999, all charges against Richardson were formally dismissed. And another case. In 1998, Zane was charged in Hondo, Texas, with aggravated perjury, evidence tampering, and fabrication connected to the 1990 wrongful rape conviction of Gilbert Alejandro. Gilbert Alejandro, who had been a star of the Texas State Championship high school team just 18 years earlier, was wrongly convicted of aggravated sexual assault. A woman was sexually assaulted in her apartment in Olvide County, Texas. She had been pulled inside the door and her face was covered with a pillow during the attack. The victim described her attacker, whom she glanced at during the attack, as Hispanic, about 6 feet tall, and wearing a white cap. Although police questioned a man who was wearing clothes similar to this description, no arrest was made. Instead, the police charged Alejandro with the crime some months later. The victim failed to identify Alejandro in several photo lineups, but finally made one identification from a sketch lineup and later identified him in a live lineup. The most damaging testimony, however, came from Fred Zane, who reported that DNA testing established that semen found on the victim's clothes could, quote, only have originated from Alejandro. Based on this evidence, he was sentenced to 12 years in prison. In 1994, the DNA was re-examined and the report yielded completely different results. In fact, Zane's testimony was based on testing had not even been completed at the time of the trial. The final test results, completed after the trial, revealed that Alejandro was, in fact, excluded as a depositor of spermatozoa on the victim's clothing. Based on these test results, Alejandro's conviction was overturned and he was freed from prison. As a scientist myself, I think the absolute worst sin in the profession is to falsify any kind of results. As you can plainly see with Fred Zane and the poor men who were wrongfully convicted, the ramifications are huge. Years of their lives away from their families, sitting in a jail cell, knowing they were absolutely innocent, and just completely dependent on the system for freedom, and never knowing if it will ever come. The Innocence Project, I've mentioned a couple of times, was founded in 1992, just 1 year before Fred Zane was fired for his deeds. Peter Newfield and Barry Scheck at Cardozo School of Law formed the organization with one goal: to exonerate the wrongly convicted through DNA testing and reforms in the criminal justice system to prevent future injustices such as the one in this podcast, and these are just a very few of them. This does bring up the questions on the death penalty. I know it's a hot button issue, but it's something worthwhile to discuss based on the data. Since 1989, there are more than 300 convictions that have been overturned due to DNA evidence. 17 people have been wrongfully convicted and sent to death row. Despite this, wrongful conviction statistics has seen with a significant increase. It still remains an issue throughout the country and often leads to devastating consequences. 60% of people who have been wrongfully convicted with DNA testing have been financially compensated, but in some cases, an average person who has been convicted with this method has already spent 13 years in prison before being released. In the United States, 3,944 years have been served by innocent people in prison. In Texas, 46 exonerations cases have been reversed to false conviction after they were solved by DNA testing. According to the wrongful conviction statistics in Texas, there is approximately 72% of wrongful convictions involving eyewitnesses' false identifications. But since 2000, 40% of all convicted crimes were recorded due to direct DNA testing. According to the California Innocence Project, there are several issues that arise during the initial police investigation, during the trial, and during the post-conviction proceedings that lead to wrongful convictions. Therefore, all the issues regarding the increase in wrongful conviction statistics point to the criminal justice system. Reforms are needed and must be available to prevent the occurrence of wrongful convictions. I don't know the answer to whether the death penalty should be overturned in all states or not. I haven't done enough independent research, to be honest, besides that for this podcast episode, to make any concrete decisions based on my personal values. I do know that the numbers are staggering for wrongful convictions. Even if it was just one person wrongfully put in prison, or worse, put to death, based on flawed scientific data, it's an absolute travesty. We can do better for misdemeanors, for death penalty cases, and for everything in between, if we're willing to foot the bill. It'll cost money to achieve the quality of justice we claim to provide, to do more careful investigations, to take fewer quick guilty pleas and conduct more trials, and to make sure that these trials are well done. But first, we have to recognize that what we do now is not good enough. That's it for episode 5 of The Blood Evidence. I truly am enjoying creating this content and appreciate any and all feedback on how to better improve or if there are any specific cases you would like me to cover. Shoot me a DM on Instagram at The Blood Evidence or send me an email at StaceyMetz, StaceyMetz, at TheBloodEvidence.com. I would love to hear from you. And as always, if you are enjoying the show, please follow on Spotify or hit the subscribe button on iTunes so new episodes will show up instantly on your feed. I truly appreciate all listeners. And until next time, lock your doors and stay safe.